Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix with Steve Goldstein. I'm Lauren Gilger. Thank you for joining us. Coming up on the show this morning, how is Arizona's business community responding to the new $12 billion state budget? And we sit down with former Arizona Governor and Homeland Security Director Janet Napolitano to talk about the state of national security today. And as we kick off the summer this week, we are changing things up a little here at the show. From Memorial Day to Labor Day, the show is going to be focusing on local and regional coverage with a one-hour program starting at 9 o'clock. So keep sending us those story ideas. Tell us what's going on in your part of the valley. We are at the show at kjzz.org.
The trial of a humanitarian aid worker along the U.S.-Mexico border began yesterday in Tucson, and it has gained international attention. And joining us this morning with more is from the KJZZ Fronteras desk, Michelle Marisco. Michelle, Scott Warren faces more than two decades in prison, which, as you know, is a really severe punishment. Are people convicted of human smuggling for profit ever sentenced to time like that? And then as a second question, has anyone else been prosecuted without some kind of profit there?
I'll go back to last week. There was a Houston man, good example. He was sentenced to 2 years. Let me explain what he did. He was trying to smuggle immigrants stashed inside furniture. Three people were found in his vehicle in a Border Patrol checkpoint outside of a small Texas town of Soria. They were all wrapped in plastic. It had been nailed shut. The immigrants were inside that plastic 2 years. In regards to your second question, and it's a good one, no. The United States has tried to convict no more deaths of volunteers over the past 10, 12 years for smuggling and harboring immigrants, and have failed. So the short answer is no.
All right. So Scott Warren's attorney is arguing the U.S. has to prove he intended to break the law. And I wanted to add two parts here as well. One is the question is, how will the U.S. make that argument? And part two, I don't know if you want to weigh in on this, but is he seen in some ways without actual evidence of this as kind of making an example of?
Right. That's the tricky part. The second one. If he does see it that way, he has not made that argument, although No More Deaths as an organization has certainly made that argument several times. In regards to your first question, what was interesting here was there was an individual, a classic unindicted co-conspirator, Irineo Mujica. Irineo Mujica works in southern Mexico. He also works across the border from Lukeville in the small town of Sonoita. And he's accused of having sort of carnivaled and masterminded the caravans that have come up to the border. What prosecutors say is that Mr. Mujica was using his van to drive people up to the barn where Scott Warren and other humanitarian aid workers were using as sort of a way station. So they've been making this link between this massive organization that's of people moving from Central America all the way up to the Arizona border, and then back to Scott Warren and No More Deaths.
No More Deaths in the Border Patrol, gone back and forth for a lot of years. Now, this time looked a lot different because agents are accused of destroying the water jugs volunteers left out. What are some insights on that?
So in this video, you can see a Border Patrol agent. He's unscrewing jugs of water. He's dumping them out on the ground, and he's challenging the people recording him. He's almost mocking them, saying, "This is your water," you know, like he says right here, you know.
So you get a good shot. Picking up this trash somebody left on the trail. It's not yours, is it? All you have to do is tell me, is it yours? Not yours.
What ended up happening here was that video, No More Deaths released that video January 17. That was the same day Scott Warren was later arrested, hours later. And what was really interesting yesterday is No More Deaths has made this argument all along that his arrest was inspired by them challenging them with this video. Prosecutors said yesterday that, hey, Scott Warren had been under surveillance for 4 days before they arrested him. And to be fair, I've gone back to the misdemeanor trials that you and I have discussed, and those all happened at least a month before that video. So if there was any sort of challenge there by law enforcement, I don't believe it was over this video, but the video does exist.
That is KJZZ's Michel Marisco from the Fronteras Desk, telling us about the trial of humanitarian aid worker Scott Warren. A lot more to come with that. Michel will be checking in with you again on that as well. Thanks.
Hey, thank you.
Arizona lawmakers worked through the night over the holiday weekend to pass a nearly $12 billion budget, one that drew criticism from Democrats and many teachers involved in the Red for Ed movement. But one group that argues the budget should be applauded is the Arizona Chamber of Commerce and Industry. I sat down with the head of that group, Glenn Hammer, to talk more about why.
The business community across Arizona gives this budget extremely high marks. And the reason is simple. As you mentioned, it funds the rainy day fund at $1 billion. So it will be protected much better than we ever have been when a downturn comes, which we think will be many years in the future. But we love the tax provisions as well. We've done something we haven't done since the 90s, and that's reduced the number of tax brackets from 5 to 4. We've doubled the standard deduction. We've decreased the top marginal rate since probably around 2004, 2005. All while making the very important investments in education, transportation, and healthcare. We have met our sacred commitments to make sure that we're giving our teachers the 20% pay increase. This is installment 2. So from the business community standpoint, this is a excellent comprehensive budget.
We'll get into education in a moment, but when it comes specifically to the tax question, what are your hopes here? Like you say, this kind of improves the tax picture in Arizona. Does this mean more businesses will want to come here? Does it mean you'll be attracting a different type of business?
Arizona's tax code was very competitive before this. What this does, though, is that the Arizona Chamber of Commerce and Industry, we were the number one cheerleader in the business community for the federal tax changes, the Federal Tax Reform and Jobs Act. What this does is this smartly conforms with that act. As I mentioned, it doubles the standard deduction. So probably about 90% of Arizona taxpayers are just going to very simply fill out their form without having all of the brain damage that generally comes during tax season. For our businesses, our small businesses, the reduction in the top overall tax rate will be helpful, as will reducing the number of brackets. One additional point, we also do a very important reform. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled that online sales taxes should be collected. This budget includes a fix to the issue of online retailers from out of state selling goods to Arizonans, but those taxes not being collected. It's called the Wayfair fix. That is a really big deal, and I applaud our legislators and the governor for getting a very good conclusion to that very important tax issue.
So you talk about lowering the tax rate with this budget. What do you say to Democrats in the state legislature who have said that this amounts to a $300 million tax cut or more, and that is money we could be putting into things like infrastructure, like education?
Well, it's really tax reform, and the reason why is because the way the federal tax law is constructed, it lowers tax rates all the while decreasing deductions and increasing the standard deduction. So the federal tax law simplified things for most Americans and provided tax relief for small businesses as well. What we would say is that this is not really, it's not really a tax cut. It's really to prevent the additional revenue that would otherwise be collected if Arizona didn't change its law. But what we love about this is that it does it in a very, very smart way that simplifies life for probably 90% of Arizonans and makes our tax code all the more competitive when it comes to the small business side of the equation.
Often conversations about attracting an educated workforce to the state, about attracting businesses to the state, end up being about the education system, right? About proving to people that they want to live here, that we have the kinds of schools they want to send their kids to. And this budget, though it does add a lot to education, still leaves our education K-12 system as one of the lowest funded in the country. Do you think that we need to do more to fund that in order to attract a better business community here?
Well, I would say this. In terms of the plus-up investment, it's $700 million. The so-called Invest in Ed, which would have destroyed small business in this state, they scored their proposal, which would have been very economically destructive, at $750 million. So basically, here you have $700 million of new investments into our K-12 system, into our university system, and our community college system. All the while, we're able to do tax reform. All the while, we're able to get our rainy day fund up to $1 billion. Why? Because the economy is rocking and rolling. And I would say that we will continue to be able to make additional investments in education, and we will support those investments, but we will do it in a way so that our economy can continue to grow so that we can afford those increased investments.
I also want to ask you about SB 1451. So this is the bill that creates several new requirements for paid petition circulators to put a measure on the ballot. The chamber has been very supportive of bills like this that would add some restrictions to the voter initiative process. Why do you think this is important?
Well, first of all, let me just say we strongly support the voter initiative process. And I'll just say I admire citizens who go out there and try to change law. That's admirable. The issue comes down to when this becomes a situation where for-profit company, then we love companies making dollars, but the issue is that there have been a lot of instances where people have been filing signatures who shouldn't, who have faulty records. And this is very common sense. What it does is it would prohibit identity thieves and people like that from engaging in collecting signatures. There's other things that they can do, but they should not be involved in our electoral process.
Critics, though, would say that this is a, you know, a thinly veiled attempt to kind of toss out valid signatures, right? Like, you can forget to include a circulator's registration number on a form, and the whole form gets tossed out, including all the valid signatures that may have been on it. What do you say to that?
Well, the focus of this is really on going after people who have no business being in the petition signature business in the first place. Yes, we do have strict compliance, and that was through some other reforms. I think it's important for listeners to realize that let's think about the voter initiative process as sort of it's another form of lawmaking. If you're in the state legislature and the House and the Senate pass a bill and one bill is missing a T that is completely irrelevant to the bill cannot be transmitted to the governor. So we should have high standards when something is going to change law permanently in this state.
You've mentioned the Invest in Ed initiative several times now, and that was one that was tossed out because of, some would say, technicalities like this. So this, to you, is not about going after or restricting or making it more difficult to get things on the ballot for voters.
I think most Arizonans would agree that people who have been convicted of identity theft should not be out there hustling and trying to get signatures for a ballot initiative. And this does not affect one bit volunteer signatures. And I would bet the farm that we're still going to see ballot initiatives, citizen initiatives on the ballot in 2020, even with these new common sense requirements.
All right. Glenn Hammer, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Arizona Chamber of Commerce and Industry. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
The number of people in our state's prison system is going up, and we are not getting safer. That is among the main findings of a new report from Arizona Town Hall, a nonprofit organization that works to create dialogue among diverse populations. To do it, they held more than 20 community meetings across the state, including two in prisons. And they took what they heard from those diverse conversations and asked one central question. Here's Arizona Town Hall President Tara Jackson.
Where are we hearing the same thing no matter where we have the town hall? Where are the prosecutors and the prisoners and the people in Yuma and the people in Flagstaff saying the same thing? We look for the trends of where we need to make changes, perhaps, in our criminal justice system and how to do that.
So let's talk about the main findings from this report then, from these 20 meetings and all of the people across the state from diverse backgrounds that you talked to.
I would say the most important finding is that we're putting too many people in prison and it is not making us safer. The way I might rephrase that is that we have been operating under a story that tough on crime makes us safer. Instead, what all the facts and the discussion show is that being smart on crime makes us safer. And smart on crime means that you don't automatically put everyone into the criminal justice system in prison. It means that you look at diversion programs, you look at treating substance abuse and mental illness before someone lands in the system, mm-hmm. that is a much better and more productive use, not only of our money in our tax dollars, but it is a better way to create stronger communities.
And tax dollars are a big part of this, right? You also looked at the cost of incarceration in the criminal justice system here in the state. What'd you find?
Well, this is a low figure, but minimally it costs each person in Arizona over $500 to support the criminal justice system. And that's at the low end in looking at all the costs.
So you were able to find through this that there is consensus, like you say, you look for these trends. What do you hear everywhere? So across party lines, across demographics, it seems that people agree there needs to be reform. What kinds of things did you hear from people? Are there stories that you remember that really led you in this direction?
We know from the research and the statistics that our communities are safer if we handle substance abuse and mental illness with treatment before someone lands in the system. Mm-hmm. And so increasing services there, having diversion programs if someone is stopped or arrested, are much more effective in making them a productive member of the community than throwing them in jail for a long period of time. Then in the prisons, we heard incredibly heartfelt stories from people who said, if as a child anyone had cared for me or shown an interest in my future, it would have made a big difference. These are generally children who are growing up in very vulnerable situations. And so the investment of resources, it doesn't have to be money, but the investment simply of resources of adults and a caring person reaching out to those children can make a big difference. And then, of course, everything in between.
So there were a lot of proposals by state legislatures at the state capitol this year to address criminal justice reform. This was bipartisan, and very few of them ended up making it through. One did. It aims at sort of changing the way people are charged as repeat offenders. So from a policy point of view, what are you recommending here? What do you see needs to change?
Think about your physical health, for example. If you take preventative measures early on, you're less likely to end up in the expensive emergency room. If we take preventative measures with our criminal justice system early on and those who might land in it, we're less likely to be spending over $1 billion in our prisons with an outcome that isn't all that great for those who serve the time. Mm-hmm. There's a high recidivism rate. So, for example, providing more investment in schools with school counselors, providing policies that look at diversion programs for mental illness and substance abuse. Pima County has some great programs that are showing incredible results. So looking at some of those programs based on evidence and studies that, one, keep people from being put into the criminal justice system to begin with when the evidence shows it's more effective to keep them out. But also, once you get in the system, it is a very worthwhile investment to provide education and training for the prisoners in the system. And then once someone is out of the system and back in the community, it can be very challenging to reintegrate back into the community if we put restrictions on them where they can't get jobs or do certain things that keep them from integrating back into the community. So looking at those policies also to say, do we need them? Do they serve the purpose we want them to serve? Mm-hmm. Do we really want to keep everyone who has served their time as a felon from getting jobs and being a part of their community?
It sounds like a lot of this is not necessarily what you would think of as quote-unquote criminal justice reform. Like, you're talking about things that begin in childhood and in schools and then also happen after somebody might be out of the system. Do you think that a part of this is sort of changing our perspective on what this means and what we mean when we say we have an incarceration problem in our state?
Absolutely it is. That's why I say that talking about it in terms of being smart on crime as opposed to tough on crime will get us to those answers. We know that if we can either reduce what are called adverse childhood experiences or provide support that allows resilience from those experiences, that we can keep that child from growing up and maybe committing crime or going into prison. We know we can do that. But it takes a change in mindset, not only for the average citizen, but for our legislators and our lawmakers to realize that investing in treating mental health and substance abuse has big paybacks in the end whereas putting people who suffer from mental illness or substance abuse into prison rarely has any good outcomes in the end. The Department of Corrections is the single largest provider of mental health services in the state. And that is not a statistic that we should want. That is not the best way to treat those with mental health issues.
Tara Jackson is the president of Arizona Town Hall. Tara, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
In an election period that didn't look as good for Arizona Democrats as November of 2018 did, Janet Napolitano came on the scene and was elected the state's attorney general. She then narrowly won the race for governor in 2002 before being reelected in a 2006 landslide. But on the national level, Napolitano was clearly best known for taking on one of the most challenging positions in federal government, Secretary of Homeland Security. She served for 5 years in that position as one of the original cabinet secretaries in the Obama administration. National security is at the heart of Napolitano's first book, How Safe Are We? I spoke with her earlier this week when she was in the Valley for an event with Poison Pen Bookstore. I started by asking her how important the border is when it comes to truly making the U.S. secure.
You know, it's not in my top three, that's for sure. The border is not itself a threat to the safety and security of Americans. We face much greater threats from risks associated with climate change, much greater threats in the cyber world, much greater threats from mass gun violence. You know, the border is a zone. It's a zone to be managed, but it's not inherently a security risk.
So does it bother you then when that gets so much emphasis? It's obviously been used as a political division tool of some sort, but even the way it's been emphasized that when there were the migrant caravans, that, oh, maybe there are hidden terrorists in there.
If you listen to the news today, if you listen to the White House, you'd think that all that the Department of Homeland Security does is the southwest border, where the responsibilities are so much broader. And actually, in terms of protecting Americans, other areas, including the three I've mentioned, are areas where there's much greater risk to safety and security.
Well, let's assess climate change first then, because there are going to be some people maybe on the other side of the aisle who are going to say, wait a second, climate change. Even if they believe in climate change, they may not see it as a national security risk. So why is it?
I'll begin with the most obvious, the relation to extreme weather events. So we have more landfall hurricanes. We have a greater number and intensity of tornadoes. We have drought in the far west, which has dried out our forests and led to massive wildfire, which has caused loss of property and loss of lives. Lots of lives in California this year. Mm-hmm. Another area is its global impact. So its effect on global migration patterns. We're actually seeing a mass migration from south to north across the planet, associated in large part to new types of plant diseases that have wiped out crops and extreme drought. That has wiped out local agricultural economies. And that means a lot of people without work, a lot of young men without work and without a future, and they become very ripe themselves for terrorist recruitment.
So cybersecurity you mentioned as well. And
yes.
People have seen that in all sorts. Our privacy, of course, is affected by it. We also saw it in elections. People are expecting to see even more in 2020 from external bad actors, how we want to put that. That seems like one of those that, because of what happened in 2016, maybe even the average person's antenna are up for that. Do you feel at least there is more of a commitment to solving this one at this point than there may be for others?
You know, it's an extraordinarily complicated and difficult issue. You know, it affects so many things. It affected our actual democracy, as we saw in 2016. But it poses a risk to the safety and security of our communities. Why is that? Why? Because so much of our critical infrastructure is in private sector hands. It's all networked. We've already seen hacks. We've seen denial of service attacks, you know, where you actually shut something down. And we really do not have a strong national grasp on how to loop in the private sector, how to have national cybersecurity standards that are enforced and enforceable, and then how do we prepare individuals and communities should they be subject to some kind of a cyber attack?
How bad is partisanship these days compared to even when it was when you were Secretary of Homeland Security, and does that make it harder to solve these problems?
Oh, the partisanship makes it extraordinarily hard. This is a country that has, you know, we have big issues to address, issues involving our energy policy, issues involving how we educate the next generation, issues involving our fiscal health. And to achieve solutions in those kinds of areas really requires individuals to be able to stake out a position and compromise and move the needle, and then you start again and you move the needle some more. But right now we're in a situation where everybody retreats to their corner, and there's really no kind of cross-party discussion or negotiation.
So a lot of people want to blame that on President Trump. Was he a part of that? Was he sort of a product of that? Was he sort of the big spotlight for the average person to realize that, or has this been going on for much longer than many of us would think?
I think it's been developing for a number of years, and it certainly has accelerated in the past two and a half. But we saw, for example, I think it was the day after President Obama was inaugurated, the majority leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, said his top priority was to make sure that Barack Obama didn't get a second term. And he said that at a time when the nation was teetering on an actual depression. We were already in a deep recession, where there needed to be immediate emergency action to kind of save the American economy and get it back on better footing. So I use that solely as an example of the fact that partisanship has been with us for a long time. But it has gotten worse, and there's no doubt about that.
Now, your current position has you in leadership in California. I know President Trump already doesn't seem to like California, so I don't want to give him more ammo. Is he the worst president of your lifetime? At least when it comes to some of these security issues that we talk about, because there seems to be even those who would support him to some extent, they'll talk about unpredictability. And those who are on his team will sort of say, well, that's good. That means that maybe some of these leaders in North Korea or Iran don't really know what we're going to do. But does that make the country feel less secure when you have a president who is unpredictable, let's put it that way?
It's not so much the unpredictability. It is the isolationism of the United States. And homeland security really requires international cooperation and strong alliances to share actionable intelligence. For example, it was our strong alliance with Great Britain that tipped us off to a plot to put explosives on planes hidden in the printer toner cartridges for computer printers. And we were able to intercept that plot. We were able to retrieve the explosives. And then we were able to reverse engineer what was going on and tighten up so that it couldn't be repeated. It's that kind of sharing of intelligence that really strengthens our homeland security. And so I do worry when the president's comments seem to undercut the value of those alliances.
How difficult was the job of Secretary of Homeland Security? Did it ever freak you out that you were in this position?
It's a very challenging position. It's challenging from another number of aspects. First of all, the responsibilities of the department are so widespread. It's a responsibility for land, sea, and air border security. It's responsibility for our transportation networks. It's responsible for pandemic. It's responsible for coordinating the response to oil spills of national significance, as we saw with the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. It's responsible for disaster response. FEMA is part of the Department of Homeland Security. So it has very broad missions. It is comprised of what formerly had been 22 different agencies that were brought by different legacy departments, some from Treasury, some from Justice, some from Transportation, and so forth. And then some new ones created out of whole cloth like the TSA. And so just from a management perspective, it was challenging. But, you know, I was there for almost 5 years, mm-hmm. and we made, I think, some significant movements in the department to really unite it and to integrate it. What I am concerned about is that this sole focus on the southwest border at the Department of Homeland Security detract from these other important responsibilities.
So going back to the name of your book, and we've talked a lot about some of the issues, so how safe are we? I mean, are we less safe over the past 4 to 6 years than we were, or last 2 to 4 years, let's say?
Well, let me, the department was created in the aftermath of the attacks of 9/11. Mm-hmm. And I would say that the changes we've made really prevent such an attack from occurring again. So in that kind of an arena, we are definitely safer. But, you know, the risk environment continues to evolve. The risks we've talked about today have only increased over the past 4 to 6 years. And that's really where we need to focus our efforts.
Mm-hmm. Now, Secretary, when you were governor and you and I used to talk frequently, we would have to talk politics. So I'm going to ask you about national politics for just a bit. So in the Democratic Party, there are more than 20 candidates at this point for president. Do you have general observations about how you see that? Because it seems like a circus at this point.
I have not endorsed a particular mm-hmm. candidate. And given my current role, I don't think that I will be. But I'm listening. And what I'm looking for is a candidate that grasps the issues, seems to have some good policy ideas for how to address those issues, and then has that certain it, that certain something that can excite people and bring them together. You know, that's what Barack Obama did so well in 2008. And I don't know that we have another Barack Obama in the current group of candidates, but it's early, and we'll have to see who emerges.
Do you miss the political side of it, or because you certainly had a reputation when we would talk, you're someone who just was so hands-on. Did you ever have another itch to sort of do that after you were Secretary of Homeland Security?
No, not really. When the president asked me to serve a second term as secretary, I thought that I certainly didn't have another 4 years in me. Being Secretary of Homeland Security, among other things, is just a physically exhausting job. You really do get those 3 a.m. phone calls and so forth. But I thought I had, you know, if I did another year, that would give the president the opportunity to nominate and get somebody else confirmed, mm-hmm. And for that person to have a decent amount of time in the office. So I said, well, maybe another year. And I got to thinking about what I'd like to do next. And, you know, when I was governor, I so enjoyed working on issues of higher education. I wanted to move back west if that were possible. Mm-hmm. So I thought running a small college out west would work. And I ended up running the largest public research university in the country. But it is in the west. Yes. It is in California.
I wanted to ask about whether you think Arizona actually is a purple state now, as people like to say.
I think Arizona will be in play in 2020. It may be somewhat dependent on who the Democratic nominee is, but Trump won the state by 3 points, something like that. It was not a landslide here. Mm-hmm. And the election last fall was pretty good for Democrats overall. You know, not only the Senate seat, but the Secretary of State, the Superintendent of Public Instruction. I do think it will be one of the focuses of the national campaign when 2020 rolls around.
She was the Arizona governor, also former Secretary of Homeland Security. She's also a first-time author now with How Safe Are We? Janet Napolitano. Janet, after all these years, nice to see you again. Thanks.
Good to see you.
This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Lauren Gilger, along with Steve Goldstein. Still to come, we'll have the latest on the Navajo Nation's fight to stop oil drilling in Chaco Canyon. And we're doing things a little bit differently this summer from 9 till 10. Now until Labor Day, we are focusing on stories about our state and our region. The Takeaway will air from 10 to 11 as we follow this summer schedule. So please continue to send us those story ideas at the show at KJZZ.org. In recent weeks, KJZZ has reported on a bitter dispute over imported Mexican tomatoes, as well as a massive threatened strike in Sonora, Mexico, the state to Arizona south. To get the latest, we've got Murphy Woodhouse on the line from our Fronteras desk in Sonora's capital, Hermosillo. Good morning, Murphy.
Good morning, Lauren.
So you've been doing a lot of reporting on the still unresolved dispute between Mexican tomato growers and importers and some domestic producers. There's a lot of moving parts here, so let's just get up to speed. Start there.
Yeah, so since I was last on the show, a lot has happened. May 7th was the effective date for 17.56% duties for imported Mexican tomatoes, and that was also the date that an anti-dumping investigation was restarted. That was what the suspension agreement, the tomato suspension agreement, had suspended. Since then, the Mexican growers have sued the U.S. government, seeking to block both the charging of those duties as well as the resumption of that investigation. And they also put forward a new tomato suspension agreement, which they thought very highly of, but which the Florida growers quickly dismissed as, quote, a step backwards. So negotiations don't seem to be going terribly well, and there is now a lawsuit to boot.
Wow. Okay, so what impacts, if any, can be seen in places like Nogales on the border, where hundreds of millions of dollars worth of tomatoes cross every year?
For sure, yeah. So I've been checking in regularly with Guillermo Valencia, and he's both a produce broker there as well as the chairman of the Port Authority, and we've got some tape from him.
Well, I think most people are getting adjusted to all the changes. From my standpoint, we're not collecting. We've been collecting duties on shipments for a couple of weeks now. And those duties are coming out between $1,500 and $2,000 per shipment.
So if there is ultimately a deal, or if Commerce finds that there was no dumping, those duties could be paid back. But for the time being, the required bonding is pretty expensive, and there have been fears of a shortened season and complications for planning the next season.
Mm. Mexican growers and importers warned of possible declines in imports and price hikes for U.S. tomato consumers. Any evidence of that yet? Are we seeing prices go up here?
So there's not a lot of evidence for that yet. I've been keeping a pretty close eye on USDA data, which monitors both import weights and prices. The available data for May so far shows pretty much the same import levels through Nogales and along the whole U.S.-Mexico border, though in Nogales it's down very slightly and no real clear jump in prices. So Valencia said he wasn't that surprised to hear that and said that the most major impacts would likely not be seen until the fall when Commerce may make a final determination on duties.
Last week, you reported on a major Sonoran union threatening to go on strike this summer. Any developments on that front?
Yeah, so just to quickly recap, that was the Sonoran branch of the Mexican Workers Confederation. They've got about 130,000 members in the state, and they are at over 2,000 businesses. Worth pointing out that they also have a presence at the major Ford plant here, as well as a number of parts suppliers and other automotive businesses here in Hermosillo. That threat and strike obviously put the business community on edge, and many described it as a potentially illegal act. And I actually was told by an export leader yesterday that they're actually contemplating getting court protection from a possible strike. But anyway, the union itself says that the strike is designed to improve federal medical and housing services here in Sonora. The head of the union said that he's meeting with the heads of the relevant federal agencies and is in fact meeting with the head of the Social Security Administration here in Mexico today. He said those have been fairly positive meetings. And I also asked him just right out, you know, how likely he thought the threatened July 8th strike was. He said it was not likely, but not impossible, and it all depends on how negotiations go.
All right. That is Murphy Woodhouse joining us from our Fronteras desk in Hermosillo, Sonora. Murphy, thanks so much.
I always enjoy it.
The Navajo Nation and the Pueblo Tribe have won a small victory. The U.S. Department of the Interior has agreed to delay leasing out land to oil and gas companies around the Chaco Culture National Historical Park.
Located in northwestern New Mexico, the canyon is home to ancient settlements where the ancestors of the Pueblo tribe lived over 1,000 years ago. It was once an economic and ceremonial hub for the region, and it is now a UNESCO World Heritage Site. A 10-mile buffer zone will keep the site protected for at least another year.
After visiting the site earlier this week, Interior Secretary David Bernhardt said he walked away with a greater sense of appreciation of the magnificent site, which is managed by the National Park Service, as well as a better understanding of its cultural significance to tribes.
The delay on leasing will give the U.S. Bureau of Land Management time to finish drafting an updated management plan to guide energy development on federal land across that region. Bernhardt asked that the plan include an alternative that reflects tribal leaders' views and the boundaries sought by lawmakers.
Environmental groups are also pleased by the decision. Kyle Tisdale is the Climate Energy Program Director at the Western Environmental Law Center. He previously told the show they had filed lawsuits against BLM because of their concern over proper environmental surveying.
The thing that we really took issue with was BLM's practice of approving these permits, these drilling permits, basically on a permit-by-permit basis or without ever considering the true magnitude of the cumulative impacts affecting people and the lands around where this drilling is taking place.
The 328 square miles of allotted land in that area already has more than 600 oil and gas leases on it. Industry representatives say robust protections are already in place within the park and beyond.
Advocates for the site's protection approved of Bernhardt's decision, but warned this is only a stopgap measure. They're continuing to call for a more permanent protection solution.
You're listening to The Show.
The overall U.S. economy continues to be in a strong place, with job growth and unemployment numbers seeming to be very healthy. And Arizona is one of the states leading the pack when it comes to a continuing expansion of positive economic news. How healthy is Arizona's economy, and how long could the good times last? With me to talk about that is George Hammond, director of the Economic and Business Research Center at the U of A. Earlier today, he hosted Breakfast with the Economists in Tucson. George, what's your overall view of the Arizona economy? Is it strong and getting stronger, strong but trending in the other direction?
Arizona is doing really well. We're generating strong job growth. Our population is rising. Income is rising. The unemployment rate is down substantially from where it was just after the Great Recession. So we've made a lot of progress in driving the unemployment rate down, but it has been stubbornly above the national average, and it's even begun to tick up a bit over the past 6 months or so. What's driving that is actually the fact that Arizona's labor market, our job performance, has been so dynamic. I think what that's doing is it's attracting more residents to the state, and it's pulling discouraged workers off the sidelines and back into the labor market. And when that happens, when people move into a state or they restart their job search, they tend to go through a spell of unemployment. So I think that's what's happening in Arizona. I expect the unemployment rate will start to trend down again soon.
And how much of the state is benefiting from all of this? Because usually when we see the economy take off, certainly Maricopa County benefits from that.
Well, certainly the fastest growing area of the state has tended to be the Phoenix metro area, particularly Maricopa, but Pinal has been growing as well. Tucson is also continuing to add jobs, but at a somewhat slower pace. Tucson added about 4,300 jobs last year for 1.2% growth. The Phoenix metro area generated 3.3% job growth during the same period. So, most of the state is growing, but, the real engine of growth in Arizona is the Phoenix metro area and Maricopa County in particular.
How much longer do you think growth can be relatively strong? And does it necessarily mean that with some clouds on the horizon that 2020 will not be good or just maybe not as good as we've been seeing?
Overall, I think what's going on is that, and what the our forecasts suggest is that the national economy is going to make a transition from above trend growth to growth that is a bit below trend over the next couple of years, and that means that we will likely see slower growth in Arizona, Phoenix, and Tucson once we get into 2020 and 2021. And when you see that kind of growth pattern, that transition from above trend growth to a bit below trend growth for the national economy, that implies that recession risks are elevated. Now, the most likely outcome at this point still is continued growth over the next couple of years, but those recession risks are elevated, and it's something we're going to want to keep an eye on as we go through the rest of this year.
How closely are you watching trade agreements, the relationship the U.S. and Arizona have with Mexico, for example?
Yeah, that matters, and the tariffs that have been instituted and the trade tensions, I think, have had an impact on growth nationally and here in Arizona. So certainly it will be nice to see those disagreements get sorted out. Trade, particularly trade with Mexico, is really important. Mexico is by far our largest and most important trading partner. So getting the USMCA done will certainly help smooth our path forward.
So let me ask a sort of the follow-up on the potential slowing down question. Are there specific things that would indicate to you whether or not we're bound to stay in a strong place? Or because I think for some people, trade, tariffs, concern them in terms of whether the growth will be slowed, even in part because consumers may not be able to spend as much.
What I'm going to be watching closely over the next year is what's happening with initial claims for unemployment insurance. That's an early indicator of labor market performance. It reflects layoffs. Those initial claims are currently trending down, but we'll be looking for them. If they were to start trending up in a significant way, that would be a warning sign. Also be keeping a close eye on what's going on with construction activity, particularly residential construction. So tracking indicators like housing permits will be key. And housing permit activity is volatile, but it does look like it has taken a bit of a pause in recent months. So that'll be an important thing to track. Nationally, keeping an eye on what's going on with interest rate spreads, say between the 10-year and the 3-month rate or the 10-year and the 2-year bond rates, will be important indicators to track going forward. That tells us a lot about what financial markets are thinking about future growth. So those three key indicators, they still are indicating continued growth, at least in the near term, but they'll be three to watch going forward.
And during the midst of the Great Recession, there was talk here in Arizona that by diversifying economy, do you think over the past decade or so the state has moved in a better direction as far as diversifying the economy?
Well, I think the economy is more diversified than it was, say, in 2006 when we headed into the Great Recession. But we still have work to do on that score, and in particular, focusing on educational attainment really across all levels is key. You know, as we look forward in coming decades, demographics are going to matter, but what's going on with technology and automation is also going to be important. And the states and the metro areas that have higher concentrations of highly educated individuals are going to be much more able to capitalize on new technology trends, and they're going to be much more resistant to job losses that are being spurred by increased automation.
George Hammond is director of the Economic and Business Research Center at the University of Arizona. You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Well, a lot of us started in this hobby as kids. My stepdad started me out when I was 8 years old. This train, which is one of mine, is the 1953 Southern Pacific Daylight. We have the ice cream truck with all the kids buying ice cream on that side. That's Superman. He's doing Overwatch on the creek here. We have a little bit of whimsy all over the layout.
Awful.
This is a glimpse into a world that I missed. Doing and loving this hobby, I'm able to, through my modeling, capture that era.
That's Alan Vincent running model trains with the Thunderbird Model Railroad Club. If your suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want to choose us, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.